This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Right now, in the midst of the ever-changing news cycle, there is a humanitarian crisis at hand. But you kind of know that. You may not know the details. You may not know that the United Nations says about 20 million people face famine in parts of Africa, but you probably know that many people are starving there. That, unfortunately, seems to be so much of what we ever hear about Africa. It just rarely captures America's attention. The food shortages have gotten critical in Nigeria, South Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen. And there's something else you might think you know. You might think you know there's nothing you can really do about it. That the problems in Africa are so deep that it would take miracles to fix them. But is that true? In this hour, we hope to broaden what you actually know about Africa's famines, what's causing them, who is making them worse, and what could make them better. And if you're inclined to help, we'll consider different ways of making a difference. Joining us here in studio is Jeffrey Gettleman, the East Africa Bureau Chief of the New York Times. His memoir is called Love Africa. Jeffrey, welcome to 1A.
Thank you very much.
Also with us is Carolyn Miles, the president and CEO of Save the Children. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, thank you.
And Jathi Kabui is an organic chef, urban farmer, and food activist originally from Kenya. He joins us from member station WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Jathi, glad to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
We welcome your questions and thoughts about Africa's famines, what's going on, and what can be done about them. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Jeffrey Gettleman, let me start with you. We began with kind of my thesis that people kind of think they know what's going on in Africa. It's the sort of story that we don't pay a lot of attention to, and because it seems so giant and intractable, we don't really hook into it. What's the one thing from your reporting that you wish more people knew about what's really happening in Africa?
That's a big question. I think Africa also feels very far away. I think a lot of people that are listening and a lot of people that I'm friends with have never set foot there. And it feels exotic, it feels foreign, it feels disconnected from our lives. The thing that I would want to share is that even though there's a lot of conflict, even though there are many troubles, even though we're right now talking about a famine and a lot of people's lives are on the line, there is a spirit and a sense of interconnectedness in Africa that makes me really enjoy living and working there, that people are more open-hearted and have more time for each other. You can even see it in the way handshakes are exchanged on the streets of Nairobi, Kenya, a big, busy city. People come up to each other, they shake hands, and they continue to hold each other's hands while they start their conversation. They don't just sort of retreat and drop away. And so I think we have this perception of Africa as a very violent, turbulent place, and we forget that there are, you know, other sides to the culture there that gets lost in this noise, which is often really grim and disturbing.
Jathi Kabui, does that kind of echo your reflections of how we deal with the African famine here in the United States?
Yes, in a way it does. As a person who spent 20 years in a farm and 10 years of my life in the city, that definitely reminds me of how people treated each other as I grew up.
Carolyn Miles, let me start with you in terms of painting a clearer picture of what's going on there. Now, your organization, Save the Children, is a charitable organization trying to help people who are combating famine. What do you think is the one biggest challenge that you deal with in your organization when you know where aid is needed, when you know what the problem is? What is usually the biggest impediment? Is it government? Is it environmental? Is it logistical? Is it fundraising? What tends to stand in the way?
Well, it's a great question, and I do think it depends on what country you're talking about. And Save the Children has worked in Africa for a very long time. We're almost 100 years old, and it's been a part of what we've done for a long time. And our biggest area of work is actually in Africa. And I know we'll get to this a little later. It's not the kind of charitable work that people might think it is these days. But in each of these four countries, where, as you said, there's 20 million people at risk, there are also about 1 million children, by the way, at risk of starvation. So, but each of these countries is quite different. In Somalia, the real issue is the drought, and that those droughts are coming much more often. And this is a country of people who are pastoralists, which means they depend on rain for their animals. That's how they make their livelihoods. So that's one set of situations. You have South Sudan, which has been mired in conflict for the last several years. And there, it's really the violence and that ongoing violence that puts people most at risk and makes getting them food and water and the basics really, really difficult. You have Yemen, where, again, you've got this overlay of violence that again, has been going on for years. And there, you do, though, have a relatively vibrant economy in many of those towns and cities. So we are able to leverage that when it comes to how we respond. And then northern Nigeria. And again, that's just one place in a country where, you know, there's a lot of stability in other parts of Nigeria. So it gives us the opportunity to do more in that country to get people to help themselves because there's more capability. So I would say each one is quite different. Kenya and Ethiopia are also being drawn into this issue because refugees are leaving. They're streaming out of these countries and they're going into Ethiopia and Kenya, which into particularly the very risky areas, which again are under tremendous drought conditions. So it's really, on the one hand, it is enormous, but I would say, you know, to your viewers, there is a lot that can be done. And I just got back from Somalia and saw a lot of that work.
And we'll I do want to hear more about what you're seeing as well. That's Carolyn Miles, the president and CEO of Save the Children, Jeffrey Gettleman of the New York Times, and chef and food activist Jothi Kabui. We also want to hear from you, too. What questions do you have about the ongoing crises in Africa regarding food insecurity and what's being done to help save lives there? Email us 1A@wamu.org. Comment on our Facebook page or tweet us. We're at 1A. Jeffrey Gettleman, I think the one of these four that Americans probably might be the most passingly familiar with might be Somalia, because we've heard it in the context of drought and famine in Africa in the past. Also maybe Yemen, but not in relation to famine. We hear about Yemen in relation to terrorism and the U.S. fight against ISIS and other groups. Are these two issues interconnected? Is America's attention in the war on terror and the world's attention on famine in this part of Africa separate, or are they linked?
I think they are linked. I also think, in answer to the previous question, one of the toughest challenges right now is that these four situations are happening at the same time. We've never seen that. It's very hard to deal with one famine, let alone four, and it really stretches the resources of organizations like Save the Children. It stretches the UN, and it's also happening at a time when we're very distracted. There's a lot of political turmoil in the United States. There's, you know, a grinding war in Syria. People are not thinking about Africa the way they had been a few years ago. And so I think this idea that, you know, our focus is still on counterterrorism. We still care deeply about national security issues, and you see that in Somalia. That's, you know, there was a Navy SEAL who was just killed in Somalia a couple weeks ago, the first combat death in more than 20 years. And I write about this a little bit in my book. I mean, the U.S. has a long history in Somalia, and they've made some big mistakes. The intervention in the 1990s was a disaster, and it sent Somalia deeper down the road of chaos that it's in. And then in 2006, the U.S. went back and they made some bad policy decisions, and that resulted in a famine a few years later. So we're sort of stuck in a rut with Somalia, and sadly, it's not that much different than it had been 20 years ago.
It's interesting that you note the response in Syria. One of our listeners, John, emailed, President Trump was moved by babies being gassed in Syria with a hard power response, but wants to cut back on international soft power affecting African famine, with children dying even more miserable deaths. And I do want to talk about that a little bit more as we go on. But Jothi, let me come to you for a moment. I understand that among the environmental causes for these famines that are happening in some African nations, your home country, Kenya, is also dealing with drought. We're up against a break in a moment, but how are you seeing that play out in Kenya?
The government of Kenya just released two brands of corn flour, in order to reduce the cost of flour by half, which is the most commonly consumed food product in Kenya right now, because it was at the verge of almost collapse, where the food prices doubled within the last 2 months. And we obviously know that's not sustainable. So, yeah, so in Kenya, there's a very big problem with food security right now. But as an anthropologist and a food activist, I'm always kind of set aback every time I hear people who come to Africa with good intentions, and the very first thing they see are animals, you know, the country is beautiful, which is true, or the people are nice. But what they don't see is the causes that are emanating from the West, their search for resources, influence, a political influence, and some of the economic disparities in trade relationships between Africa and the rest of the world. Those are the underlying causes that I don't think comes up as clearly as maybe how nice the country is, or how nice people look.
Well, we will make time to talk about those underlying causes as our conversation goes on with organic chef and food activist Jathi Kabui, Carolyn Miles of Save the Children, and Jeffrey Gettleman of The New York Times. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the famines in some African nations with Carolyn Miles of Save the Children, Jeffrey Gettleman of The New York Times, and organic chef and food activist Jathi Kabui. We welcome your thoughts as well. Share what you know about disaster relief in African nations. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. We've been getting a number of emails from listeners about what some of the causes of these various African famines might be. One listener wrote on our website, the1a.org, corruption and dictators are the problem. Nothing some nation building couldn't help. Zachary also wrote on our website, war is never ending in many African countries where national boundaries were set by the European powers to divide their colonial empires without consideration for ethnic or religious differences. Jeffrey Gettleman, how much of what is playing out as famine is actually caused more by human actions than by the environment?
Most. What unites these four countries is the fact that they all are in conflict right now. So in Nigeria, you have a horrible conflict with Boko Haram. South Sudan is in a civil war. Somalia is fighting an Islamist insurgency. And Yemen is totally torn apart by a factional religious-based war. That's what unites these countries right now in their famine situations. You take a nation like Kenya. Kenya's facing the same weather patterns as Somalia. They're right next door. It's equally dry. But you can get food to areas in Kenya because you don't have to worry about roadblocks and rebels and mines and other obstructions to delivery of aid. So that's what we have to remember. But the climate change issue is a serious problem. Parts of Africa are getting hotter and drier, and there's millions of people who are living right on the brink that are now being pushed over. And what's sad about the situation is Africa produces almost none of the pollution that's contributing to global warming. If you look at a map of the African continent at night, while the rest of the world is lit up with electricity in certain areas, most of Africa is dark. And the Africans who live in these dry areas are suffering from the pollution of other nations.
By the way, I should back up for a second before we get too far along. We've mentioned Yemen along these nations. Yemen is technically not part of continental Africa. It sits on the other side of the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, kind of east of Eritrea and Djibouti and Somalia and Ethiopia. Is Yemen something we should include conceptually in this conversation about African famine? Is there enough similarity or is Yemen kind of its own thing?
I think Yemen is its own thing. It's not part of Africa. The culture is very different from a lot of sub-Saharan Africa, but it's affected by the same weather patterns that are creating drought and affecting the food supply and the conflict. And a lot of the aid organizations, like Caroline sitting right here, they work in both places, and they're stretched. You know, they're trying to respond to a famine in South Sudan. They're trying to respond to a famine in Somalia. They're trying to respond to a famine across the continent in Nigeria. And then they have to worry about, you know, getting food to starving kids in Yemen.
Carolyn?
Yeah, I think just to pick up on a couple of points here, I do think obviously the conflict is part of what brings these countries together. But having just been visited Somalia, I think there are also these intense impacts of climate change and livelihoods that people have. So in northern Somalia, the way that people live is they're pastoralists. They have goats and camels and sheep, and they move around the country grazing those animals. They sell 2 goats a month to make enough money to feed their kids and send their kids to school. They sell 2 camels a year. And when those animals die, there is nothing for these people. That's it. So one of the things when I was there that we were gently, I think, talking to families and parents about is there a different future there for their children? Because these droughts are coming in faster and faster cycles. They don't recover. Their herds don't recover. This lifestyle that they have is really under threat. And so we believe that there also has to be this diversification piece. You know, one of the most powerful things that I saw when I was there was a program, and this gets to some of the questions about is this just the same old way that we've always done aid? And I will tell you it is not, because one of the programs I saw there, which was so powerful, was we were actually giving mothers, and this was important that it was mothers, cell phones, small basic cell phones, not smartphones, loading them with money that then these women could take to their local convenience, you know, general store, and they could actually transfer that cash via text to the merchant and buy what they needed. Huh. That is not the way we have usually done aid. Tremendously effective, tremendously powerful for these mothers to be able to do this. And it was funny, I asked them, how did you figure out how to use these? And they said, oh, we just asked our kids. I said,
exactly.
Some things are the same everywhere,
like
around
everywhere
the world.
Else.
Everywhere else.
I should note, by the way, I just was playing with Google Maps just now to see how broad an area, because Jeffrey, you mentioned this vast swath of land, from Lagos, Nigeria, which is the coastal major city in Nigeria, to Sana'a in Yemen, as the crow flies, is about 2,800 miles. That is farther than the flight from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco. So this is a vast amount of land that we're talking about, and quite diverse, and a lot of land to stretch resources around. Jathi, I wonder about the listener's comment regarding corruption. What do you see in and around Kenya as it relates to government's ability to respond to hunger, to drought, to food insecurity, and whether corruption plays a role?
Maybe if you can allow me to just say something very brief.
Sure.
About the same comment that they made about Yemen being away from Africa. Mm-hmm. Number one, from Djibouti to Yemen is about a day's and a half boat ride. So it's very, very close. It's number one. They're responding to the same issues that I mentioned earlier about where is the problem coming. Jeffrey was very, very correct in talking about the source of pollution that is causing climate change in some of these African countries comes from the West. Well, if you look at the problem with Yemen is right now surrounded all around where people cannot actually not leave the country by Saudi Arabia or coalition of forces that are led by Saudi Arabia. And the problem is religious and political issues where Saudi Arabia is trying to prop up a government that's very unpopular with the Yemenis. And the government is actually propped up to fight the Houthi rebels who are being supported by the Iranian government, because Iranian government is Shia and the Saudi Arabia government is Wahhabi and Sunni. So you have this cross-section of politics and religion, which is a powder keg all of Africa. If you look at Boko Haram, is trying to institute Sharia law, for example. So you have all these people who are getting money from certain very powerful countries like Saudi Arabia that are causing instability in very politically weak countries in Africa. So, which is the same thing in Yemen, for example. So I wanted to say there's a very big connection between Yemen and Africa. But now talk about corruption.
Yes.
Corruption and the ability to fight food shortages in Africa still have the same underlying causes of the economic relationship between the West and Africa. A lot of countries in Africa are indebted to the IMF and the World Bank. And some of these loans are given in such a way that it discourages the government from subsidizing their farmers. So Kenya right now is importing a lot of corn. It's going to pay a lot of money to, they say they got the corn from Mexico. It's not even sure about that, where the corn came from, because there's a lot of corruption even around the importation of corn, which is a very basic commodity, food commodity in the country. But these countries could not subsidize their farmers, corn farmers. Okay, because of the way the aid and the loans are packaged. But now they have to spend way more money, maybe 50 times more money. I don't know. I don't have the figures, but you can just imagine it's much easier to subsidize the farmers and feed themselves instead of importing these corn price, bags of corn. So, yeah, corruption has a lot to do with the way the loans and the aid and the economic relationship between the West and the in Africa.
So, Jathi, I want to make sure that your point isn't getting lost. It sounds like what you're saying is that there are dollars flowing into some of these countries, and they are even dollars that can be used to buy food, but because of the way the deals are written, they can't be used to provide food domestically for that nation's own people. They have to be used to import food, which doesn't help people who live off the land. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's part of what I'm saying. But if Americans are subsidizing their farmers, and some of these agencies, economic groups that loan money to Africa, put conditions that keeps the governments from subsidizing their own farmers, then you have a problem. And the problem is because Americans are subsidizing their farmers so that their corn can become more economically more viable as a commodity in the international international market.
Gotcha.
But if the playing fields are open and Americans don't subsidize their farmers, then the corn prices are going to be high and the African corn is going to be more marketable in the international market. And therefore, some of these countries that are growing corn can be able to compete in the market. But now the market is not an open field. There's nothing open, fair, free and fair about the market.
Let Jeffrey from the New York Times jump in. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Well, a couple things. President Trump is talking about slashing foreign aid by 25% or more. That's going to have an enormous impact across the region we're talking about. It's also going to have an enormous impact on American farmers because so much of the food aid, if you go to a refugee camp in Somalia, one of the first things you're going to see is a stack of huge bags of grain that are stamped with the stamp that says a gift from the people of the United States. So much of the food aid that comes to Africa is grown in the United States. So I think there are going to be some implications back home of those cuts. But another point I wanted to make is this idea is Africa's very vast, and actually the amount of good quality land is running out because of climate change, because of overuse, and at the same time the population is growing very fast.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Since you referred to Africa and its growth, we've gotten a number of comments from listeners about the way that we refer to Africa. Kate tweeted us, "I think it's important to stop referring to Africa as a whole. Referring to it only as Africa increases colonial ideology." Another listener tweeted us, "Geez, 1A, Africa's not a country. 54 countries, 1.2 billion people. Seriously bad reporting and perpetuating a colonial mindset." Okay, let's just take a breath for a second. We refer to Europe as a continent. Europe refers to itself continentally. How much is that comparison off base as it relates to feeding hungry people? Should we be more discreet, more specific with our language, or are there really continental aspects to dealing with food insecurity in Africa? Carolyn, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the answer is somewhere in between, right? As we've talked about, these particular countries that we have been talking about are all under this same climate condition, these same climate conditions that are causing tremendous drought, and then you've got this overlay of conflict. So there are some similarities, but also to your listeners, I think pulling each of these out, there are different things that are being done. I think, you know, from Save the Children's standpoint, we obviously, you know, we look at each country differently and separately, and we look at what it is that we need to do to, in this case, to actually save the lives of children who are going to starve if we don't actually do something. And the responses there are slightly different, but, you know, I'll give you one example that is actually pretty similar in all four of the countries that we've been talking about, is you've got to get children who are severely malnourished stabilized. So we are running these stabilization centers where these kids that, you know, having been there, you think these children really will die if they don't get the support they need. And that's intravenous feeding for children to get them to the point where they can actually eat food, right? These are kids that are so weak, they can't even eat. So that is that's something similar that we're doing across all four of these countries. But this program that I talked about with cell phones, we're doing that in some places. In other places, we're actually able to, again, this gets to some of the points about it's just about dumping food into Africa. You know, a lot of the aid now is not straight food aid. It is actually looking at how we get cash into the hands of people who can access markets. So we have, you know, cards that are preloaded so a family can actually get a card that they can then go to merchants and buy the things they want to use.
Although
that is much better aid than dumping food into a community or an area of a country where actually there's things to buy, and that's what you really want to do.
Although I do take the listener's point, it is kind of pathetic when you hear somebody say, "Oh, I heard that story about Africa. It's so sad what's happening in that country." Yeah. No, sweetie, no.
Yes.
No, it's a bunch of cuts.
Yeah, we don't want to be part of that.
Yes, exactly.
Thinking. So
yes.
I totally respect your listeners from that standpoint.
Go buy a Google map and just look at Africa for real. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
I just want to jump in on that because I take a lot of heat as a New York Times reporter writing about Africa. And I've just published a memoir called Love Africa. So I've set myself up for this. It cuts both ways, though, because there are certain similarities that sub-Saharan African countries share. They have a very similar colonial history. They face many of the same problems. If you look at the development statistics, African countries resemble each other much more than they do any other part of the world as far as lifespan, the diseases they face, their economies. And also, there are organizations in Africa that celebrate this unity. The African Union is what Africa has decided to call its intergovernmental organization, the African Development Bank. And so I don't think we should be too scared of using the term Africa to refer to this part of the world. But I also think we have to make sure everybody understands that these countries are dealing with different specific issues and they have different stories, even if they do have a lot of similarities.
We're up against another break in just a moment, but I want to get in another aspect of the conversation, and maybe Jathi, if you could begin responding to this. I'm going to have to cut you off, but I'll let you finish when we come back. Kwazi emailed us, "I'm originally from South Africa, but live in Philadelphia. The extraction of minerals by outsiders leads to those inside struggling to prosper by selling out." Barbara emailed us, "China and other powers have a major presence in Africa, extracting resources, importing and exporting workers, making huge profits at the cost of the environment and people's health. Can those powers be held responsible for solutions to famine and drought?" Again, we're up against a break, but Jathi, could you begin thinking us through how the commerce of other nations affects Africa's famines?
So maybe, again, seems like I'm always one step behind. I wanted to give my position that one of the biggest problems that Africa is facing is because it's divided. In America, I can travel from New York or go all the way to San Francisco without having to go in the boundary, without having to change money. So that's a problem. Mm-hmm. There's a major move towards Pan-Africanism as a way of approaching some of the problems of Africa. Now, back to your question, I also take great offense when I hear the point that you made about the way the food is stamped that's being given aid is a gift to Africa.
Hey, Jathi, hold that thought 1 second. We got to take a break. I'll let you finish on the other side. Stay close. Back now to our conversation about fighting famine in various parts of Africa with Jeffrey Gettleman of the New York Times, Carolyn Miles of Save the Children, and organic chef and food activist Jathi Kabui. Jathi, sorry to cut you off before we had to pause. Let me let you finish your thought and then we'll keep going with more questions.
Sure. So my point was about President Trump giving aid to Africa and the food, some of these food that's being sent there, being stamped as a gift of from the American people. And so my question is, how is it Africa is providing all these useful minerals and products to the rest of the world, and to the West, for example, gets very low prices for those products, are not allowed to export, have very high tariffs for manufactured products from Africa, but yet now is getting aid? What about just having a fair system? Why some of the reasons why African countries are doing very poorly is because they follow the advice of the Western countries to apply liberal economic systems, a neoliberal economic system that was supposed to work. That didn't work. But if you look at countries like Japan, a country like Korea, a country like Taiwan, that actually, and a country like China, it defied some of those liberal policies, and they had a economic system that are actually state-driven, instead of borrowing money from other countries and opening up their market for these other countries to come and compete with their product, to where they'll never be able to actually produce enough things for themselves, and they'll be net exporters. Those are some of the problems that are causing Africa to be always dependent.
You know, let me bring Carolyn in on that note, because I know, Carolyn, you wanted to chime in on China's role in this. And also, for sure, you know, Jathi's right. Africa has been mined very heavily for a number of minerals, including some rare earth minerals, which if you are listening to us on any kind of digital device, some of those minerals from Africa are in that device. That's how we make them work. And there is no place really richer on the planet with those minerals than Africa. And it seems like Jathi makes a good point in terms of the commerce that goes on in parts of Africa, but it's not reaching the people. It's not feeding those people who most need it.
Well, I certainly agree with Jathi that isn't the proceeds from those minerals and all of the other wealth that Africa has doesn't get down to the people. And that's where we come back to the corruption issue, I think, for the most part. But I think one thing we all need to think a little bit about is, and I don't disagree at all in terms of the role of the West in really taking advantage of those riches in Africa. But I think we all also need to pay a little attention to what China's doing in Africa, because the kind of investments that China is making in Africa are all based on how does China even a greater level, exploit the riches that are there. And there's this One Belt, One Road idea that's just been released this week, actually, from the Chinese government, which is basically, how do we connect everything to China?
This is the trade conference.
All of Africa.
This is the trade conference that China's President Xi Jinping was just leading in Beijing to try to create a new infrastructure route through and around China, Eastern Europe, into Africa, the various gulfs and ports and seaports and roads leading to and from China.
That's right. And what you see inside of a country like Kenya, for example, and Ethiopia, is these huge infrastructure investments that China is putting in, building roads, building tunnels, building ports. And that is all towards this One Belt, One Road idea. And so I think we all have to understand what's happening with China in Africa. And frankly, part of this is filling a void, because other countries have said we're not going to make, and the kind of investments that the U.S. and other countries make in Africa are quite different, I would say to you. And I would say that these days, those are really about empowering people in Africa. That's not what China's doing.
Jeffrey?
Africa has always played a role historically of being a supplier of natural resources. This goes back to the Heart of Darkness that Joseph Conrad wrote, you know, more than 100 years ago in the scramble for ivory. sadly, that's Africa's way of interacting with the world economy, is producing raw materials. And that's the problem, because it's not going to be sustainable to have hundreds of millions of people trying to make a living off the land through agriculture or through mining. There needs to be more industry. And I agree with the other participant that the world has discouraged Africa from industrializing through a lot of its policies.
Greg emailed us. Jeffy, were you trying to jump in?
I still wanted to make a very
sure
my point, which I don't think got through, that I hear about feeding people, but I'm not interested in about feeding people. Don't feed me. Let's talk about fair prices. Let's talk about, I know there's corruption, and I don't for 1 minute defend corruption for anyone, even if it's on my own mother benefiting from it. My point is very clear. If we are only talking about feeding people, then we are taking people as pets. What about talking about the bigger point about people being economically empowered to be able to make their own decisions and make enough money? Let's talk about fair prices for some of these minerals that people are getting. Okay, I understand the point. Yeah, the money is not getting to the point to the people. But if only the money is $10 getting to the people or that came in, but the actual product that was sold, well, maybe for $10 million. Okay, if you're talking about $10 million, that's very different from talking about $10. A lot of the minerals and the products that come from Africa are sold at very, very low prices. And that money can be used to build stable, sustainable economies in Africa.
You know, Jathi, it's a good point that you make, and let's shift in that direction since you bring it up, because a number of our listeners have been talking about that as well. Mahad tweeted us, what's needed is training of individuals on agriculture and small business management, not bags of food dropped from airplanes. Another one of our listeners wrote on our website, the1a.org, Carolyn Miles mentions that giving women access to money has been extremely successful. This brings up a problem that's seen in pretty much all charities. People don't want to give other people money because they don't trust them. We always think that we know better than others when it comes to what they need. Carolyn?
Yeah, I think just to jump in there, I think what people don't like to do is, I don't think they don't like to give individuals money. I think actually that people are becoming, particularly a lot of our young supporters, are very comfortable with doing that. So that is not, I think, the issue. They want to make sure that obviously there's control and that it gets to the right people and that it doesn't get lost along the way. And you can use technology now to do that in a much, much bigger way. But I think the other thing we have to remember about what's going on in these four countries, kind of where we started, is, you know, there is a need, I would premise, that we need both kind of aid where we have to save some lives here. I mean, there are 20 million people at risk. There are a million children at risk of starving. We do have to do things to help those people that maybe people would think of as traditional aid. But we also have to look at these underlying issues. And in Somalia, one of the biggest issues, and it goes back to things, something that we were talking about earlier, is, you know, people have to be able to adjust their livelihoods and be able to do things differently. Being able to subsist on being a goat and camel herder in a country like Somalia, where the land is getting less and less able to support that kind of livelihoods, that's not an answer. One of the things for us is education for kids. If we don't, and about half the kids in Somalia are out of school, they don't go to school at all. So how are you going to change that country and give people those opportunities that we're talking about if the children actually never get a basic education? So that's a place where we're going to be putting even more of our efforts in the future.
One more foundational question about these famines in various parts of Africa, and then let's focus on solutions, what works, what could work, what maybe hasn't worked, and then where we go from here. Tim emailed us, has Africa always suffered from famine as we think of it today? How has the relationship to famine and who and what is to blame for it shifted over the centuries? Is this something recent of the last few years, or is this longer lasting than maybe recent memory? Jeffrey?
There have been famines in Europe in recent memory. I mean, there's famines all the time. Famines are cyclical. Weather patterns change. People suffer because they rely on the land, and when the land can't produce food, people don't have enough food to eat. I don't think I don't think the situation in that sense has really changed. But I do think that there are more conflicts happening right now as we're sitting here talking. And that is imperiling millions of people. And we can talk about big picture issues and deeper reasons behind this. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that a lot of the people who are suffering had nothing to do with this. They're just going about their lives, and the warlords in their part of, you know, where they live start fighting each other, and they cut off the supply of aid, or people create pollution in other parts of the world, and it totally turns their local weather system upside down.
Yeah, some of the recent famines around the world, at least in the 20th century, had to do with human conflicts and causes. I mean, the famines after World War II, China's Great Leap Forward, where we don't even know exactly how many tens of millions of people died, could be upwards of 65 million people died, have had human causes that maybe the world needs to deal with. And actually, there are some, certainly within the UN and elsewhere, who are trying to deal with this. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres addressed this at an aid conference in Geneva last month, asking other countries for about $1 billion in aid. The UN says that if there is no help provided, about 17 million people in Yemen will be at risk of starving to death.
A child under the age of 5 dies of preventable causes in Yemen every 10 minutes. And this means 50 children in Yemen will die during today's conference, and all those deaths could have been prevented. Many of the children who survive will be affected by stunting and poor health for their entire lives. We are witnessing the starving and the crippling of an entire generation. We must act now to save lives.
That's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking in Geneva last month. Jeffrey, who do you see internationally on a government level who's leading the way in fighting these famines in Africa? Is it the African nations themselves? Is it the UN? Is it another national power? Is it China for its economic interests? Who's leading the way?
I don't think anybody's leading the way. And that's the problem. It's like a scramble. Everybody's trying to respond and put out these fires at the same time. The UN agencies are there to assist in development and relief, like UNICEF, like the World Food Program, like WHO. And then there's a whole world of NGOs, of private organizations, like Save the Children, that are working hard to get food to people who need it. But there really isn't a superstructure in place. And if there is one, it's under attack right now. And people are questioning, should we even contribute to foreign aid? We're in a very inward-looking moment, and it's playing out in Africa.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. I want to talk about solutions and options for the rest of the time that we have together. Jathi Kabui, what would you say would work in terms of relieving some of the strain of the various famines in Africa? You are a food activist and an urban farmer who thinks about these issues very deeply. Give us an example of something that you've seen that works, that could work even more if it just had a little more support.
Thank you very much. I still say that... If you look at a country like Yemen, where I think America gave, up to last year, gave $450 million in aid to help the people who are starving there. But during the Obama administration sold $150 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia, then that shifts the balance. That becomes very, very complex situation to talk about help in that case. But let's talk about solutions, for example. The solutions are going to come up only when we are really honest about the problem, the cause, root causes of the problem. I'll give you an example of something that's happening right here locally in North Carolina.
Briefly, because we're low on time.
There's a farmer who is a white lady, and she's retiring, so she decided to give the farm, her farm, for free. She asked people to write an essay, and whoever won the essay, she would give the farm to that person, especially somebody who is less likely to get a farm for themselves. That's a good example. And the other conversations that are going on, those are progressive things in which people are realizing that because of the racial disparity in this country, the chances that a farmer in America a black person would just get a job and buy from the size of a misnomer buns is going to be very difficult. So if America and the West are serious about dealing with those problems, we can. That's one example that I gave. The examples that are targeted where we're having people who are investing, for example, in buying growing trees in Kilifi, a project that I'm involved in. So we grow trees as a way of economic investments for, let's say, instead of 401k, where you grow trees, you sell the trees. The trees are used to affect climate change, and the grass grows better in dry area, and we can grow livestock, so we're getting food. So we're doing three things at the same time. We're giving somebody employment, we are affecting the climate, and we are transferring direct resources, and these are done without gender. It's actually very, very offensive when you come and give money to my wife, and you don't give me. That means there's a problem that we need to address. Why are we only giving women money? Why are we only giving men money? Why can't we give the family money? If there are issues, we can address those.
Let me get to you, Carolyn, in our last few minutes on the program. For people who look at these famines in various parts of various nations in Africa and still think these problems are quite intractable, and that the best they can do is just give some money to an organization like Save the Children and basically cross their fingers, what would you say to them?
Well, two things. I would say that in the short term, you know, giving money to organizations like Save the Children to do the relief efforts that we're talking about, getting, malnutrition, kids that are suffering from malnutrition, getting them food, getting water, getting support to livelihoods, those kinds of things, it is the right thing to do. And I think people shouldn't feel that those things don't make a difference because they will save lives. And that's important. In the longer term, we obviously need to take on some of these other issues and things like debt relief, things like making sure that populations of children get educated and actually have other alternatives to some of the livelihoods options that they have now, these issues that we've talked about in terms of corruption. It's not that we don't need to get to those, and a lot of the development programs we do that. But right now, you can save lives.
And Jeffrey, very briefly.
I have one word, which is empathy. If we had more empathy for this part of the world, this all connects. Africa seems like this very foreign, disconnected place that we can sum up with one word, Africa. These are real people like us. And if we felt a little more connected to them, we would be able to help more.
That's Jeffrey Gettleman, the New York Times East Africa Bureau Chief. His new memoir is called Love Africa. It's just out this week. Jeffrey, thanks for spending the hour with us. Jothi Kabui is a chef and food activist. Jothi, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And Carolyn Miles, the president and CEO of Save the Children. Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you, Joshua.
1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.